welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, naturalist and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder. He was recorded speaking in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium as part of the evening author readings at UAA, hosted by UAA's Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program on July 8th.
Gary is someone who really needs no introduction, but on an occasion like this, he nonetheless must be introduced. Gary's been a prominent figure in the American literary scene since about 1955, with a background in Buddhist studies and Asian culture. He lived in Japan as a student for 9 years. He's most usually referred to as one of the beat poets, along with Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Michael McClure, people like that. And people also, of course, associate him with Jack Kerouac. And he was present at the famous six gallery reading where Ginsberg first read Howl, and people have never forgotten that either. His fifth book of poetry was Turtle Island in 1974, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. There have been since then 15 more books. I was looking back at Turtle Island recently, just anticipating Gary's visit, and I found it startlingly fresh. Anyone in public life today is very familiar with the concept of sustainability and its importance and necessity. Gary's been telling us about that since the early 70s. He's basically a visionary in that sense, and no one has been more articulate about that subject since then. He's an early proponent of bioregionalism. He's lived in the Sierra foothills at a home that he built since 1970. He's an advocate and activist for the Yuba River watershed and Turtle Island, the indigenous name of North America, which he's familiarized reading people with. Today, when he's talking to our students, he happened to mention in a very offhand way that when he and his friends began doing poetry readings in public, there weren't that many of them. It wasn't a popular thing. But then he said, well, but we did hear Dylan Thomas read, and we heard W.H. Auden read, and we heard Rutke read. And then Rex Roth, we sat at his soirees and talked poetry all night. And of course, the we is the people who have become some of the largest names in 20th century American poetry, Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg, Michael McClure, Lew Welch, Philip Whalen, very, very important figures for American literature. So the lineage that's present in the room when Gary's in the room is quite a pedigree, and by extension, if you believe in 6 degrees of separation, we're all, have the opportunity to be part of that lineage. We're very grateful here for his presence, his generosity, and please join me in welcoming Gary to Anchorage.
It's a little bright in the eyes.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you. Now look at this new campus here. The last time I was in Anchorage to speak and visit with the University of Alaska in Anchorage, it was downtown. And it had a corten roof and corten siding. Now I realize that Alaska is rich. It takes money to build a place like this. Poor California, all broke. It's very nice to be here again. And I'm grateful to David Stevenson and everybody in this program that is amazingly articulate and hip for letting me be part of it for a few days. I had forgotten how far it is from Sacramento to Anchorage by plane. 2,000 miles. Also, I had forgotten that it doesn't get dark at night up here. Although I have had the benefit of many travels up here in Alaska through the 70s and the 80s in particular, with the backing and help and sometimes work for the Alaska Humanities Forum, and also as a co-leader on a few backcountry trips up in the Brooks Range, down the Noatak River, down the Tatshenshini River in southeast. And I was asked today if I felt that being in Alaska, I was still in my own sort of biological, ecological territory. And at first I said, you know, I'm not sure, because I know we're north of the northernmost range of Douglas fir, which I've always kind of measured myself with or kept in track of it with, in track of myself in terms of, but then I thought, however, you know, also as a climber, I'm used to going to timberline and being above timberline, and timberline here is up, you know, in the Brooks Range, or just on the other side of the Brooks Range. So that's not unfamiliar. It's great to be here. And tonight I'm going to do what I'm doing is a poetry reading, a few older poems, a few poems that I owe in part to Alaska, and then some recent poems. And I hope I won't bore you too long. As a way of opening from a volume called No Nature, a selected volume, a poem from 1957 called Oil. When I was working as a engine room seaman, a wiper, for 7 months on a tanker, I got seaman's papers when I was 18 out of New York, and Coast Guard seaman's papers, and membership in the Union, Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, and was able to make several trips on the basis of that over the years. And I still have those papers, and I still have my union card. And so one really long trip, the one that is reflected here in this poem, I actually signed on to out of Yokohama, Japan, through a bar in Yokohama that had a hiring hall in the back. You go through the bar, through another door, and then you're in a hiring hall with a blackboard on the wall. And before I knew it, I was on board a ship that was sailing out of Yokohama Bay, headed for Guam, a tanker. Soft rain squalls on the swells, south of the Bonins late at night. Light from the empty mess hall throws back bulky shadows of winch and fair lead over the slanting fantail where I stand. But for men on watch in the engine room, the man at the wheel, the lookout in the bow, the crew sleeps in cots on deck or narrow iron bunks down drumming passageways below. The ship burns with a furnace heart, steam veins and copper nerves, quivers and slightly twists and always goes, easy roll of the hull and deep vibration of the turbines underfoot. Bearing what all these crazed, hooked nations need, steel plate and long injections of pure oil. 1957. I wish I hadn't been so right. During my years living in Kyoto, Japan, mostly studying Buddhism, primarily the Zen school of Buddhism, in my spare time, I took up the study of ecology. Back in the days when ecology was really a branch of biology, and very good English language bookstores in the bigger cities of Japan, the Maruzen bookstores. So I got a very nice textbook on more or less scientific ecology in English to read in my spare time and sort of bring myself up to speed a little bit. Working with that over some months, I hit upon what at that time ecology was about. It was about things eating each other. It was actually about energy transformation and energy transfer from among organisms to other organisms with ventures out into the inorganic world as well. So I wrote a poem called The Song of the Taste, which is about what human beings eat. Eating the living germs of grasses, rice and wheat. Eating the ova of large birds. The fleshy sweetness packed around the sperm of swaying trees, apples. The muscles of the flanks and thighs of soft-voiced cows. The bounce in the lamb's leap. The swish in the ox's tail. Eating roots grown swole inside the soil. Drawing on life of living. Clustered points of light spun out of space, hidden in the grape. Eating each other's seed. Eating, each other. Kissing the lover in the mouth of bread, lip to lip. In Catholic terms, that would be called a sacrament. Yeah. And one more poem from, a couple more little poems from these earlier years. And this is a little condensation of history from the mid-60s to the early 80s. It's called Building. And I really had sort of forgotten about this poem, but then the other day I got a letter from Oxford University Press saying that this poem has been selected as one of the 100 most notable poems of the last 20 years that will be in a new anthology that they are bringing out. And I thought, I didn't think it was that good. Let me look at it again. And then I realized, well, it's historical, if nothing else. You'll recognize the history here, I'm sure. So it's called Building. We started our house midway through the Cultural Revolution, the Vietnam War, Cambodia in our ears, tear gas in Berkeley, boys in overalls with frightened eyes, long matted hair, ran from the police. We peeled trees, drilled boulders, dug sumps, took sweat baths together. That house finished, we went on. Built a schoolhouse with 100 wheelbarrows. Held seminars on California Paleo Indians during lunch. We braised the Zhou dynasty form of the character Mu on the blacksmith brackets of the ceiling of the lodge. Buried a 5-pronged vajra between the school buildings while praying and offering tobacco. Those buildings were destroyed by fire a pale copy rebuilt by insurance. 10 years later, we gathered at the edge of a meadow. The Cultural Revolution is over. Hair is short. The industry calls the shots in the people's forests. Single mothers go back to college to become lawyers. Blowing the conch, shaking the staff rings, we opened work on a hall. 40 people, women carpenters, child labor, pounding nails, screwed down the Quartin roofing and shaped the beams with a planer. That building was done in 3 weeks. We filled it with flowers and friends and opened it up. Now, in the year of the Persian Gulf, of lies and crimes in the government held up as virtues, this dance with matter goes on. Our buildings are solid to live, to teach, to sit, to know for sure the sound of a bell. This is history. This is outside of history. Buildings are built in the moment. They are constantly wet from the pool that renews all things, naked and gleaming. The moon moves through her 28 nights. Wet years and dry years pass. Sharp tools, good design. Hopefully optimistic. I'd like to read now from Mountains and Rivers Without End, and I've selected a couple of poems. In this long poem, which is constructed of poems, came out of my travels and experiences up here. You'll see. This is called Arctic Midnight Twilight. Cool north breeze with low clouds, green mountain slopes, white mountain sheep, the bee song. The bee is the Koyukon word for the Dall sheep, the mountain sheep up there, the white one. Green mountain walls in blowing cloud, white dots on far slopes. Constellations slowly changing, not stars, not rocks, by the midnight breezes strewn. Cloud tatters, lavender arctic light, on sedate wild sheep grazing, tundra greens, held in the web of clan and kin by bleats and smells to the slow rotation of their order. Living half in the sky. Damp wind up from the whole north slope and a taste of the ice pack. The Primus roaring now. Here, have some tea. A broad bench, slate surfacing. 6 sheep break out of the gorge. Skyline, brisk, trot, scamper. Pellet piles in moss. A spiral horn in grass. Long tundra sweeps and the rise of slopes to a peak of Dunarak. White sheep dots on the far green. One chases one. They run in circles. 3 move away. 1 cuts a tangent. On the shade side canyon wall, scree patch, rock slides, serried step up ledges. A host of sheep hang out. Sunshine across the valley. They choose the chilly shade. Perched on cliffs, napping, scratching. Insouciant white head droops over gulfs of air. Low sun swings through the 24 hours. Never high, never gone. A soft slant light. Miles of shadows, ever dappling clouds. A sheep skull forehead with its horn prongs, sitting on a boulder. An offer of the flower of a million years of nibbling forbs to the emptiness of intelligence. Sheep impermanence, sheep practice, sheep shape-shifting, vows of beings, Fajra sheep teaching the Koyukuk waters suchness for each, the beat of her unseen feet, which the wild sheep hear, at the roof of the planet, the warp of the longitudes gathered, rips in the wind-built tent of sky, sea, earth, cycles, eating the green of the 24 hours, breaking the cloud flock flight with floods of rising, falling, warmer, cooler, air mass swirls like the curls of doll sheep horns, the feet of the onward paces of skulls and pellets. Clouds sublimate to pure air, blowing southward through passes, feeding the white dot doll sheep dew. A sheep track followed by a wolf track south of the lake. A ewe and lamb in the sunshine. The lamb tries to nurse. It's too old. She lies down in the scoured out gullies, 31 sheep. Climbing midnight mountains, sliding rock, find a sheep trail that goes just right. On the harder scree at the bases of faces, follow it out over ledges and find their hidden sheltered beds. Sweet, rank sheep smell makes the heart beat. Dusty and big pebbles whisked out, so it's softer, shaped, sheep dreaming place. Sheep time all over the world. At rest in a sheep bed, at the cliff edge of life and death, over endless mountains and streams like the strips of the sky. Up the knife edge, the trail crosses over and heads down a glacier. Tracks fade in the snow, sheep gone, and only endless twilight mountains. Rest a while among the rocks. Arise to descend, to unbuild it again. And hear the Koyukon riddle. It really snowed hard in opposite directions. On my head, who am I? To be a mountain sheep. It's okay. So there's another poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley, sort of running through that underneath it. Maybe some of you caught it. Some of you who are really fanatic about English poetry. Bowers, I'll tell you what it is. It's from the poem called The Cloud. That orbed maiden with white fire laden, whom mortals call the moon, glides glimmering o'er my fleece-like floor by the midnight breezes strewn. And only the beat of her unseen feet, which only the angels hear, breaks through the woof of my tent's thin roof. The stars crowd behind her and peer, and I laugh to see them whirl and flee like a swarm of golden bees when I widen the rent in my wind-built tent till the calm rivers, lakes, and seas like strips of the sky fallen through me on high are each paved with the moon and these. Not bad, huh, for an Englishman. I hope there are any Englishmen here. That's one of the pleasures of being a writer, is that you can allow yourself to hear, you know, something else in the back of your mind at the same time. Fortunately, since we're not, you know, college students or anything, we don't mind if we're accused of plagiarizing a little bit. Actually, Chinese poetry is full of of that kind of quoting, you know, shameless quoting from previous classic poems throughout history, and they consider that simply a sign of culture, you know, that you can do that. I would like to look at it that way. Another one is called "We Wash Our Bowls in This Water," and this is not from the north. That one is from the Brooks Range. This is from the Tatshenshini River down in southeast. Quote, "The 1.5 billion cubic kilometers of water on all the earth are split by photosynthesis and reconstituted by respiration once every 2 billion years or so," end quote. Should add that the only water that is not reconstituted and circulated around like that would be that which is tied up in Arctic ice packs, Arctic and Antarctic ice packs. Otherwise, how do you like this? All the molecules of water in the ocean circulate around every 2 million years. Up in the sky, down the rivers, back into the ocean, whatever. Ah, it's charming. "We wash our bowls in this water." I should dedicate this book to Dick Nelson, who really got me started on it. A day on the ragged North Pacific coast, getting soaked by whipping mist, rain squalls tumbling, mountain mirror ponds, snowfield slush, rock washed creeks, earfuls of falls, swirls of ridge edge snowflakes, swift gravelly rivers, tidewater crumbly glaciers, high hanging glaciers, shoreside mud pools, icebergs, streams looping through the tide flats, spume of brine, distant soft rain drooping from a cloud, and sea lions lazing under the surface of the sea. "We wash our bowls in this water. It has the flavor of ambrosial dew. La shi san paswe, nyo ten kanro mi." Beaching the raft. Stagger out and shake off wetness like a bear. Stand on the sandbar, rest from the river, being upswellings, side swirls, back swirls, curlovers, out ripples, eddies, chops and swells, washovers, shallows, confluence, turbulence, wash seam wavelets, riffles, saying, "Hydraulic is a cross between a wave and a hole." You get a weir effect. "A pillow rock is a total field back over a hole, fold back over a hole. It shows spit on the top of the wave. A haystack is a series of waves at the bottom of a tight channel. There's a tongue of the rapids, the slick tongue, the V. Some holes are keepers. They won't let you through. Eddies, backflows. We say eddies are your friends. Current differential, it can suck you down. Vertical boils are straight up eddies spinning. Herringbone waves curl under and come back. Well, let's get going. Get back to the rafts. Swing the big oars, head into a storm. We offer it to all demons and spirits. May all be filled and satisfied. Om Makala Sai Swaha. Seyo Kijinshu Shichuryo Toku Ho Man Om Makara Sai Swaha. Sudanpo, Sushir, sat out one whole night by a creek on the slopes of Mount Lu, early Song Dynasty, one of China's most, probably the second most famous poet in all of Chinese history, governor of all of South China, Sushir. Next morning, he showed this poem to his Zen teacher. "The stream with its sounds is a long broad tongue. The booming mountain is a wide awake body. Throughout the night, song after song, how can I speak at dawn? Old Master Johnson approved him. Two centuries later, in Japan, Dogen said, "The sounds of streams and the shapes of mountains. The sounds never stop, the shapes never cease. Was it Su, the poet, who woke up? Or was it the mountains and streams? Billions of beings see the morning star, and they all become Buddhas. If you, monks, who are valley streams and looming mountains, can't throw some light on the nature of ridges and rivers, who the hell can?"
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder. He was recorded speaking at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium as part of the evening author readings at UAA on July 8th.
One of the final poems in Mountains and Rivers Without End is this simple poem called Earth Verse. This came spontaneously to me, flew up on my shoulder like a bug in Australia in the central desert one afternoon. Earth verse. Wide enough to keep you looking, open enough to keep you moving, dry enough to keep you honest, prickly enough to make you tough, green enough to go on living, old enough to give you dreams. I'll read it again. That's what Robert Bly always says. I'll read it again. Earth verse. Wide enough to keep you looking, open enough to keep you moving, dry enough to keep you honest, prickly enough to make you tough, green enough to go on living, old enough to give you dreams. So those were selections from Mountains and Rivers Without End. And now a few selections from another book, my most recent published book of poetry, which is called Danger on Peaks. And the peak in question, or the most concrete and specific peak in question, is Mount St. Helens, which I first climbed, was my first climb. And I was 15 years old with a party from Spirit Lake. Was absolutely transformed by discovering, which I still think is true, that being on top of a high snow peak is very much higher than being up in an airplane. And in fact, it's higher than anything else. And when I went over to look down at the landscape below, from the summit of Mount St. Helens, just went over to the edge, there wasn't anything down there. So I knew that this was a very special place. Nonetheless, we did get down. And the next morning, walked over to the Forest Service, Tahoe National Forest, not Tahoe, Gifford Pinchot National Forest. Walked over to the Forest Service, a little cabin, and there was the newspaper pinned up on the bulletin board, the Portland Oregonian for August 13th, 1945, describing the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Actually, I'm going to read this little thing to you. Spirit Lake was far from the cities of the valley, and news came slow. Though the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima August 6th, and the second dropped on Nagasaki August 9th. Photographs didn't appear in the Portland Oregonian until August 12th. Those papers must have been driven in to Spirit Lake on the 13th. Early in the morning of the 14th, I walked over to the lodge to check the bulletin board. There were whole pages of the paper pinned up, photos of a blasted city from the air, and an estimate of 150,000 dead in Hiroshima alone, and an American scientist quoted saying, "Nothing will grow there again for 70 years. The morning sun on my shoulders, the fir forest smell and the big tree shadows, feet in thin moccasins feeling the ground, and my heart still one with the Snow Peak Mountain to my back, horrified, blaming scientists and politicians and the governments of the world. I swore a vow to myself something like this: by the purity and beauty and permanence of Mount St. Helens, I will fight against this cruel, destructive power and those who would seek to use it for my entire life." Many years later, thank you. Many years later, I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they were doing quite well. And other things have turned up since, although, you know, the question of atomic weaponry is far from over. At this very moment, the Japanese themselves are demonstrating against the possibility of restarting one of their reactors that's been shut down, a perfectly good reactor, not one of the damaged ones. But they are so antsy about nuclear power now that there is a public sentiment that would stop all use of nuclear-generated electricity entirely and go to what? They've got a lot of hydroelectric, but it's all small hydro, hundreds of small hydro coming out of the mountains. And then some big old coal-fired generators, which they have to buy coal from you-know-who, us, to keep them going. I don't think they buy any from China. Talk about rocks and hard places. And so what can we say about that? There are so many things that are on the table now. That it's hard to say which is the most challenging and potentially destructive. But running out of energy, running out of fossil fuel energy, is sure one of them. So a few more poems from Danger on Peaks. Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980 and proved to be a lot less permanent than I had thought it would be. Dr. Coyote, when he had problems. Dr. Coyote, when he had a problem, took a dump on the grass, asked his turds where they lay, what to do. They gave him good advice. And then he'd say, "That's just what I thought too," and do it, and go his way. You might well wonder. To all the girls whose ears I pierced back then, when I first shipped out and went down to the Caribbean, shipped out of New York with my Seaman's papers from the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union. Incidentally, in 1947-48, when I went into the hiring hall of the Marine Cooks and Stewards in New York City, to which I had hitchhiked all the way from Portland, Oregon, there was a sign on the wall that said, "No red baiting, no queer baiting," and what was the other one? $100 fine, first offense, You're out of the union, second offense. But that union no longer exists. So, while down in South America, I got my ear pierced. It's one of the things you can do when you're at sea. And when I got back and finally managed to get into my second year, go back into college for my second year, earning some money so that I could afford to do it, it turned out that the young ladies were all ready to get their ears pierced. There had been some shift in American sensibilities right around that time, and the idea of piercing your ears was attractive. So I always did it free. But I found myself, you know, taking care of an awful lot of ears. That went on for a long time. I mean, for a couple of decades. So this is dedicated to Maggie Brown Kohler, among others, who was 7 years old when I pierced her ears with her parents' permission, right there. Now she's married to the poet Jim Kohler. Sometimes we remember that moment. You stood there, attentive, with clothespins dangling, setting a bloodless dimple in each lobe, as I searched for a cork and the right-sized needle and followed the quick pierce with a small gold hoop, the only guy with an earring back then. It didn't hurt much. A sweetly earnest child and a crazy country guy with an earring and a great green cast eye. And even then, this poem. Coffee, markets, blossoms. My Japanese-American mother-in-law, born in America, tough with brokers, a smart trader, grew up working barefoot in the Sacramento Delta on the farm. She doesn't like Japan. She sits in the early morning by the window, coffee in hand, gazing at cherry blossoms. Jean Koda, needing no poem. I read that at her funeral last summer, 92 years old. In the Santa Clarita Valley, that valley is the first valley north of Los Angeles, beyond the San Fernando Valley, on the 5. If you're going up the 5 from Los Angeles, you go in through the San Fernando Valley, and then you go over to the Santa Clarita Valley. That's a not a year-round little river, but in the winter it has some good water flow in it. In the summer, it's practically dry. Like skinny wildweed flowers sticking up, a hexagonal Denny's sign, a starry Carl's, a loopy McDonald's, an eight-petaled yellow shell, blue and white mobile with a big red O, growing in the asphalt riparian zone by the soft roar of the flow of Interstate 5. That's a little poem for the future when there's less nature, and then we have to write sensitive, observant poems about the industrial world. Well, as I said to Dave Foreman once, when he said to me, "Snyder, what do you mean bulldozers have meat feelings too?" Because I had said, you know, I don't think I want to put sugar into a bulldozer's gas tank and wreck it. And he said, why? And I said, well, you know, bulldozers have souls. I don't know why I said that. But Dave never forgave me. Dave Foreman, the founder of Earth First. And I still, you know, inexplicably believe that's true. And I was happy, actually, to have that verified to some extent by Dick Nelson, telling me that, oh, yeah, well, I was up on the Yukon River, and my friend, the older man's grown son, was having trouble getting his outboard started. He was pulling on the cord, and it was coughing and not turning over. And, you know, actually getting pretty mad and starting to cuss. And his dad said to him, don't talk like that. He said, you know, the outboard motor has feelings too. You got to have manners. One more from Danger on Peaks, which I dedicate to my dear friend Gary Holthouse, who some of you know, who was the head of the Alaska Humanities Forum here, based in Anchorage here for many years. And he was working very hard on a number of good issues, one of them being child abuse, and another being alcoholism, and another one being native language education in the villages and trying to encourage learning native languages by the argument, one of the arguments that I was mentioning earlier today, which is that, you know, only Americans and Australians might think that monolingualism was normal. And that bilingualism was just too hard. When everybody in Europe and Asia is speaking at least two languages, fluent, you know, often in at least two languages and often three or four. So, you know, get with it, folks. Learn another language. The languages are coming your way. Now, this is dedicated to Gary Holthouse, from the time that he was doing some running a little humanities center in Texas after he left Alaska, waiting for a ride. Standing at the baggage, passing time. Austin, Texas, airport. My ride hasn't come yet. My former wife is making websites from her home. One son is seldom seen. The other one and his wife have a boy and girl of their own. My current wife and stepdaughter are spending weekdays in town so she can get to high school. My mother, 96, still lives alone. She's in town too. Always gets her sanity back. Barely in time. My former wife has become a unique poet. Most of my work, such as it is done. Full moon was October 2nd this year. I ate a mooncake, slept out on the deck, white light beaming through the black boughs of the pine. Castor and Pollux rising strong. It's good to know that the pole star shifts, that even our present night sky slips away. Not that I'll see it, or maybe I will. Much later, some far time, walking that spirit path in the sky, that long walk of spirits where you fall right back into the narrow, painful passageway of the bardo, squeeze your little skull, and there you are again, waiting for your ride. Well, I'm going to finish up with some recent poems not published in any books. People ask you, "Do you write every day?" And I said, "Of course not. I don't want to write any more than I can help. It has to really insist on it before you'll let it come into the world." And there's some truth to that. My recent, the final phase of my poetry in life here is surprisingly weird, some of it. I don't take credit for it, you know, or blame. This is called Gnarly, G-N-A-R-L-Y, Gnarly, for Carol, my wife, late wife. "Splitting 18-inch old log rounds from a beetle kill, pine tree we felled so it wouldn't later smash a shed, with a borrowed splitter, Briggs and Stratton, 20-ton pressure, wedge on a piston push rod. Some rounds fall clean down, split in two. Some, tough and thready, knotty, full of frass and galleries. Gnarly. Gnarly. My woman. Gnarly. She was sweet." Hey, I gave you a good word there, you know. Not gnarly, but frass. That's a word that almost nobody knows except people who are into forestry. It's the little brown dust that beetles push out through the bark. And you see these little piles of brown powder coming out of the bark of a pine tree, and you say, "Oh, frass. It's got beetles in it. It's going to die." It's true. Claws. This poem dedicated to Philip Whalen, Zen Shin Whalen, on his death. "Graph is a graceful claw curve. Grammar, a weaving, carving. Paw track, lizard slither, tumble of a single boulder down. Glacier scrapes across the bedrock, wave lines on the beach, saying, this was me. Scat sign of time and place. Language is shit, claw, or tongue. Tongue, with all of its flickers, might be a word for sex and fate. A single kiss. A tiny cause. Claws. Such grand effects. Text." Artemis and Pan. Quoting Henry David Thoreau, "The wildness of the savage is but a faint symbol of the awful ferity with which good men and lovers meet." Ferity, F-E-R-I-T-Y. A rare word that means fierceness. "The field of the wild." Ainu term, Iworu. "Feeling the field, out back the ears, outside the eyes, faint whiff, loose knees. Two fluff gray squirrel tails whip round an oak's gray bark. Wildly horny, ferociously aloof, the ferity of lovers. Pan and Artemis, bow twang or open sight 270 barks a puff. Bring down a deer, skin it together, eat fresh liver, cooked over embers in the silvery light of the moon." Anger, cattle, and Achilles. Oh. I'm sure you all know the story of the Iliad, but I'll remind you, just in case you don't, that the great warrior Achilles, like all of the great warriors in those days, had a girlfriend. And she shared his tent with him. And so they would be out all day, you know, fighting, which is sort of like logging, with hand tools. And then, you know, come back at night, eat dinner, and go to their tent. Agamemnon, who was the chief, the admiral, or the general, so to speak, of the whole Greek army that was you know, trying to win Troy back, and so they could get Helen back. Agamemnon took Achilles' girlfriend away from him. He had, I don't know, he had the clout to do that, I guess. Her name was Briseis, and he took Briseis back to his tent, and Achilles was so angry that he almost, you know, went totally crazy. And it's a famous case, you know, in the classics. It's called The Wrath of Achilles. And it goes on for many hundreds, not hundreds, but many dozens of pages in the Iliad. That's The Wrath of Achilles. Anger, cattle, and Achilles. Two of my best friends quit speaking. One said his wrath was like that of Achilles. The three of us had traveled on the desert, awakened to bird song and sunshine under ironwoods in a wadi south of the border. They both were herders, one with cattle and poems, the other with business and books. One almost died in a car crash, but slowly recovered. The other gave up all his friends, took refuge in a city, and studied the nuances of power. One of them I have not seen in years. I met the other lately in the far back of a bar. Musicians playing near the window, and he sweetly told me, "Listen to that music. The self we hold so dear will soon be gone." Thank you. I'm going to read one more poem, and then you can clap. Oh, I love this little thing. A young woman who lives up in British Columbia, in BC, up, down, I've got to get back in. I'm thinking from California in my mind. Yeah, she's a British Columbian, Canadian woman. Many years ago, when she was 13, and I had visited the island that she and her parents lived on, she wrote me a letter that was all in rhyme about how do you write poetry. And so I wrote her back. And for many years, that was it. I never heard any more about it. So what I can add to this story now is that I finally, you know, found out that her her mother had an email address. So I was able to write her mother and say, "Well, what are you guys doing now?" Well, it turns out they were the same place they always were, except the young lady is now not 13 anymore, but almost 40. And she works as a clown and a busker and a juggler in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia. And she sent me some photographs of herself dressed up as a clown. So I don't know what she looks like now. I guess she looks like a clown. A letter to M.A. who lives far away. "Dear Melissa, I do remember you. You had curly hair and stood by the stair up there on Quadra Isle with a shy smile. Say hello to your mother, Jean. I don't remember your sister's name, and that's a shame. But I sort of remember her face and natural grace. Not all poetry has to rhyme. But this time, I'm writing back the way you did it. It's to your credit. You got me to write this form. Since real poetry is born from a formless place, which is our original face, Buddhist teachers say in play. So if this helps you be a writer, it will please your new friend, Gary Snyder.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with naturalist and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder. Hosted by UAA's Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program, Gary Snyder was recorded at one of the evening author readings at UAA, held on July 8, 2012. If you would like to listen to the event in its entirety, you can find a link to the UAA Green and Gold podcast on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.